for Wednesday afternoon, March 23rd. We are getting started a couple of minutes late, and we'll try and make that up by speeding through the process today. We have before us a couple of bills today, and we recognize that we do have committee members who are both testifying in other committees and who are on the road about the business of taking the legislature out to the people. And the only problem with taking the legislature out to Eastern Oregon is they always spell Ontario B-E-N-D. I don't understand that.
B-E-N-D.
Yeah, I just don't understand that. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2776. And I would encourage us to kind of follow along, colleagues. This has got some long-standing history with it. And we're going to have Mary kind of give us an update. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2776 will proposes to eliminate a sunset date for the Historical Property Special Assessment Program, which has a 15-year term for each property. It will allow owners of historically designated residential properties to reapply for a second 15-year period of special assessment. Under current law, qualified historically designated residential and commercial properties are eligible for a 15-year special assessment. This assessment is a property tax that is imposed on the value of property as of the application date into the special assessment program. For tax purposes, the value is frozen for the next 15 years, and assuming the value of the property appreciates in value over time, it will be less than the M50 or assessed value over the same period of time. Subject to meeting qualifying criteria and approval by the State Historical Preservation Officer, commercial properties are currently eligible for an extended 15-year period of special assessment. Prior to 2001, qualifications for entry into the program required a renovation plan as opposed to a normal maintenance plan. In 2001, however, the legislature expanded the eligibility criteria to include maintenance and preservation plans. There are currently 1,169 active historical properties in the special assessment program, of which 646 are residential properties. The 2004 M50 assessed values and exempt values for these residential properties were an estimated $425 million and $309 million, respectively. The estimated 2004 tax loss for these properties was roughly $6.2 million. Enabling owners of residential properties who are currently in the special assessment program to reapply for a second 15-year special assessment period will not substantially affect revenues during the next two biennium, because most of the 15-year assessment periods for these properties have not expired. We got this data from account-level data from Multnomah County.
Thank you.
So I could build a profile for that and see that they're not going to come off the current 15-year assessment period for several years. Okay. Moreover, if these properties are eventually given a second 15-year assessment, when they do come back on the second period, they'll come on at their market value or their assessed value, not at the frozen value that they had at the beginning of the first 15-year period. Therefore, the numbers that I've estimated for the current 600 and some entities that have the current 15-year special assessment will not be that much. However, there is another element to this, and that's that there are about 529 residential properties that previously were on the 15-year assessment, and they could come back on. I don't see that there's any reason why they wouldn't, if there's no eligibility requirements, nobody to overview it and see whether or not they have a plan, plus maintenance plans are allowed. Okay, so there'd be, in my opinion, no reason for them not to apply for the second assessment period. But trying to put a number on that, I had to make some assumptions, basically the same. I assumed the same profile, the same phasing in, and that's how I arrived at two sets of numbers there for you to look at on the revenue impact. I estimated for...
Mary, if I could just interrupt you right there, if I could, please. Those 529 properties, residential properties, which had previously been on the special assessed program, that could come back on would come back on at the current rates, at their current property tax values.
Oh, yes.
And would thus be frozen from the 3% increases under Measure 50.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct. So basically, there's not a huge impact on either one of these subgroups because they're coming on at their relatively high values, and they'll be frozen going forward. And based on, you know, relatively reasonable assumptions, I believe, and data that I picked up from the Multnomah County profile, which I applied to the 526 entities that I don't know a whole lot about, I came up with an estimate for the revenue impact for those in the, that are currently enrolled. The estimate would be 0.1 million for 0507 and 1.2 million for 0709. And if you look at both the groups of entities that could be in the program, given the second assessment, we're talking about roughly a $500,000 in 0507 and 3.1 million in 0709.
Thank you very much, Mary. We've invited James Hemerick from the Oregon Parks to come forward and just give us a history of this program. And I want to acknowledge that this bill did come forward at the request of Rebecca Pervine-Sterup and James Sterup. Those of you who have had an opportunity to walk through this grand old Champion home here in Salem recognize that it's a tremendous significance of value to the community relative to the historic value of these homes. And I want to acknowledge Jimmy Sterup here in the James Sterup here in the audience today. And we have the testimony of the Sterup family printed before us as well. Mr. Hemerick?
Mr. Chairman, nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me. James Hemerick, I'm the Assistant Director for Heritage Conservation at the Parks and Recreation Department, and I have both personally and overseen the management of the Special Assessment of Historic Properties program since 1981. Historic preservation, I was asked to basically sort of talk about the program. I also want to comment on the bill, certain parts of the bill. Also, if I could, we are proud to say in Oregon that this is the nation's oldest tax incentive for the preservation of historic property in the United States. This, when it was initially enacted in 1975, the idea was it was essentially an anti-demolition incentive. It was basically to basically help people by saving properties by being able to cut their property taxes, or at least not have it increased. If any of you were around, perhaps most of you were on the pre-Measure 5 days, this could be a substantial amount of savings for property owners, and those savings were then to be placed back into the property over a period of 15 years. In the early days of the program, there was no requirement that you do anything other than to preserve the property and to notify us when you wanted to change the property, to have us do the design review on that, and also to have a open house once a year for the public. That was considered to be a good enough public benefit. Towards the late 80s and the Measure 5 days, there came such a difference between the frozen value and the current real market value, because that's what was used at the time, that politically it became there were certain accusations about the fact that it was in fact it wasn't a preservation program anymore. Essentially, it was a program for people to basically save money on their taxes, and that was sort of the end of it. So the Parks and Recreation Commission in 1995, we introduced a bill to change the program pretty substantially, and this was done on the policy recommendation of the Parks and Recreation Commission, and essentially that was, we will give you this benefit, but we basically want you to tell us what you're going to do with the property over the 15-year period. So after 1995, people had to fill out these historic preservation program plans, and I can actually hand these out if the committee is interested in looking at them, which essentially says over the 15-year period we're going to do this, 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 and we're going to spend, we think, this, this, this money. And so it then sort of solidified the fact that there was a literal public benefit to granting this tax incentive. Because people, in order to apply for it or to be approved, had to actually agree to spend money on the property. After the advent of Measures 5 and then later Measure 50, the program has really become less useful for residential property. It's still pretty useful for commercial property, because most of the rehabilitations we do for commercial property are people are spending a lot of money, and so they're likely to get an increase. Residential applications, in our experience in the last two or three years, have pretty much fallen off almost dramatically, because people basically feel that, why should we put up with the administrative hassles, regulations, design review, plus we have to pay application fees, et cetera, hold open houses, et cetera, when the value, the net value of the tax benefit over time is essentially really substantially reduced. So we have actually had a lot. We have not had very many applications for residential property. It's certainly been cut down pretty substantially. In terms of the pieces of this bill that the special assessment program has gone through at least three sunset reviews that I'm aware of, because I was at most of them, and the last one being in 1995. And the idea of eliminating the sunset has come up more than once also. And the department is pretty neutral on this, but in my mind it was more relating to legislative policy as to whether or not the legislature wants to give tax incentives without sunset dates. So in our mind, whatever the committee wants to do about that is just fine. In terms of allowing residential property to receive a second special assessment, when the commercial property was allowed a second special assessment in 1995 in the legislation, that bill, the whole issue of that was, in fact, discussed and reviewed. But the revenue committee at the time decided no. And so that is also an issue that we've looked at. We don't have an opinion one way or the other. We think it would be fine. I think the thing that we think we would like to see in this bill, currently everyone has to file one of these preservation plans, new residential, new commercial, and reapplication commercial. We honestly feel that the policy of having a more demonstrable public benefit than just basically maintaining the property. Yes, maintenance is the program says it is a preservation, maintenance, and rehabilitation program. In our view, if you all are going to allow second periods for residential property, we think that it's in the public interest that there be preservation plans included with that. So, Mr. Chairman, I think I might have explained it, and I'd be happy to answer more questions and anything else you want to ask me.
Mr. Hamrick, the filing of the preservation maintenance rehab plans are included with the applications at present. Do they get updated any time during the 15-year life?
Mr. Chairman, the statute currently requires that we monitor or have some sort of formal monitoring of it four times during the life of the special assessment. And then the legislation is set up in such a way that if a property owner wants to amend an approved preservation plan, that can occur with this administrative review.
So basically, if the first plan was all inclusive of the life of the exemption, the applicant wouldn't have to file updated or amended plans as long as they were maintaining on these four times during the life of the plan. Then
basically, for instance, this plan, which I think I might get Paul to hand out, is basically this person says he's going to spend $80,000 on the property over a period of 15 years, and he tells you exactly what they're going to spend it on. And it's not unusual for these things to be, if you discover termites or whatever in the third year, and all of a sudden you're having to do other things. So it's a pretty flexible system.
Okay.
Really, honestly.
Other questions for Mr. Hamrick? Yes, Representative Kahn.
And maybe it's for you, Chairman Butler. Just for clarification on the bill, is this just for the commercial property, or are we also talking about residential property?
This is both properties.
Both properties.
This
okay.
is both properties.
Mr. Hamrick?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Kahn, this bill essentially would what the bill does is say that any property that's had a first 15-year period can apply for a second.
Thank you.
But it says that essentially the only people that have to do preservation plans for the second are commercial properties.
Thank you. That helps.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Hamrick? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamrick, we have signed up to testify. Let's see. On behalf of the assessors, Doug Elder, Ebner. Excuse me, Doug. And Conrad Stiver. Marion County?
Seaver.
Seaver, I beg your pardon. Doug?
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Ebner. I'm the Marion County Assessor for Marion County. I'm also president of the Assessors Association, and I was a member of the Historic Review Committee in past years. So, and I live in an old historical house, and I believe in the program. One reason why we created the extra 15 years for commercial property, in my opinion, but when we dealt with seismic, when we had an earthquake, when we dealt with seismic and ADA requirements, those are very expensive in some of the buildings up in Portland here in Salem. So we created a second 15 years to deal with that. And I think that was important. I think that preserved a lot of buildings and made them more public safety-minded for the public. When we look at residential property at that time, it never got the second 15 years because there was no seismic or ADA requirements for that. And what's important to me is that we do something to preserve properties. I think we all like historical properties. They're of interest to me. We've been around this country for a long time in our family. But I think you have to earn it. And a number of properties in the past would sign up for a program under historical and do absolutely nothing. And we review some of those applications when they review and say you did nothing in the first 15 years. And it really, to me, demoralizes the program. So what I would hope that you would do is make sure that there's something in the program for residential property for the second 15 years, that you actually spend some money on it and you actually preserve it and do something to their property other than normal maintenance. And what I also gave out is Bob Ellis, the assessor from Multnomah County. He mailed me this morning an email, and I just passed it out for your information.
So, Doug, your encouragement is to extend the program, but to insist that there be a work plan, a continued work plan, similar to what Mr. Hamrick talked about.
Correct.
That preservation, maintenance, and rehab plan be updated on the second 15 years.
Correct. And there's a follow-through with historical to make sure that whatever that plan was, that they actually did
okay.
it.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do I understand you to say that some of the folks who got this first 15 years did absolutely nothing?
When I got involved in the Historical Review Committee, especially on commercial properties, some of those did absolutely nothing that first 15 years, and that's why we required them to do something in the 15, saying you're not going to get a tax benefit for the public if you do absolutely nothing. I mean, you have to do something to earn that, and that's really important to us as assessors. Our assessment system is deteriorating.
Follow-up,
Representative.
Thank you. So what makes you think that they'll do something in the next 15 years if we give them an extension 15 years?
And that was my concern, is they have to have a preservation plan. They got to say they're going to do something, and an historical needs to
work
on that to make sure
time?
It happens. Please?
Didn't they have one the first time?
No.
Only commercial, as I recall, had to have the first
loophole.
Game
to public
enter. Get Mr. Hamrick back up and just have him clarify that for us.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. James Hamrick, Representative Riley. Until 1995, what Doug's talking about are people that were under the program before 1995, where there was no requirement. And we did have instances where people would go the entire 15 years and not do anything. We couldn't make them do it. But after 1995, we could. That was both for residential and commercial property because they would have to fill out one of these preservation plans. as part of the application
and
process.
And they did follow it.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Escobar?
Yeah, I agree with what Mr. Ebner is saying, because we have the same situation in Medford. We have a lot of 100-year-old houses, and people are on that roll where they have that frozen, and they did that prior to 95, and they have really no accountability whatsoever. I don't even think there's any accountability if you don't keep the house open, for sure. But I live in a lot newer house than you do. Mine was built in 1905. So, you know, yours was substantially older.
They take work.
And I bought myself a job. That's what I did.
Thank you. Further questions for Doug or James?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a question. We're talking about the preservation plan. I mean, how is that an accountability piece?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, in terms of how do we basically make sure that they do what they
yeah,
said they're going to do?
Yeah, ensure what they're going to do over the 15 years.
The program has built-in monitoring, and it also we also have the right to do inspections. In other words, we have right of access to the property. If I would not tell you that we go out and snoop on every single one of these people, but we have the authority to do it. I think the idea is that in the monitoring phases that come in the third, I think 7th, 10th, and 14th years, that we ask them to tell us what they've been doing, and if they haven't been doing it, then we would basically undertake some sort of remedial action.
Follow up, yes. So, Mr. Hammer, since you answered the question, I'm curious then with your monitoring process, what you've kind of described basically here. I'm gleaning from what you've said what you're doing, but can you give me a whole scale view of what monitoring is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, I personally probably couldn't, but I think here's how I would envision it going. We have approved a special assessment application based upon the preservation plan, and in that approval we basically say that X, Y, and Z is supposed to happen, and it's basically going to happen within the 3 years, 10 years, 7 years, whatever. And so and we've got it on black and white. And so if we were doing that kind of monitoring literally, if we had not heard back from them and they had not amended their application or otherwise communicated with us, we would go through line by line and see if, in fact, any of that stuff had been done. That would probably be how we would monitor those.
Okay. And if I can just follow up in that regard, that monitoring is presently part of the program in the 3rd, 7th, 10th, and 14th years. You already have that built into the things that you do with regard to these historic properties?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And we also are really, we're relatively active. We communicate with each one of these property owners every year relating to their open house dates. And we also basically at the same time remind them about their, you know, statutory responsibilities to us regarding design review. Some of these properties... We asked the legislature to give us the authority to place on deeds the fact that it was under special assessment. That happened. Before that, we had trouble with people selling and not knowing that they were under special assessment, and now it's supposed to be attached to the deed. So we don't have as much trouble with people selling historic property as we once did.
James, the annual open house or the required open houses that are required under these, can you give us some kind of a best-case scenario of what the annual open houses or the periodic open houses look like? Well attended? Do they bring people to town?
Mr. Chairman, in recent years, we've undertaken a more aggressive sort of promotion of these things. We issue press releases every month. Which are often picked up. There was an article in Oregonian this last week on the special assessment program that actually listed all the open houses in the area. So we do actually get a lot of publicity, and I do spot checks of the. We require people to sign guest lists, property needs to be open at least 4 hours, continuous hours. And it's been my experience that it's sort of mixed, but I do think that a lot of people look forward to this. We also put it on our website. And I know people that I actually know people dislike going into other people's houses for one thing, and so they go to every single one of these open houses.
Doug, does it mind you that folks come lining up at your front door on the day of your open house?
I didn't sign up for a historical program because it's an expensive item to do that. For instance, when I was on the committee, I was in the process of putting vinyl windows in my house, and James said, well, that's not historical. You got to put original wood windows. Well, you got a choice of spending $4,500 replacing your windows or $20,000 replacing your windows. Didn't have $20,000, so we have vinyl windows in the house.
No longer historical.
If you take a look, I took a look at the tax savings if I was under the historical thing for my old house that I live in. It's about a $500 over 15-year period of savings. That doesn't come anywhere near paying any part of doing anything to preserve the house as historical. It's you do it because you love the house,
okay,
and you can afford it.
So you don't, for the $500 over the life of your home, you just soon have windows that really kept the cold out.
That I can open and close.
You bet. Okay. further questions for Doug? Yes, everything, please.
Just kind of curious how common, I had an experience in my district where someone with a historic property decided that despite the zoning laws, they were going to operate a kind of a commercial enterprise holding weddings at this historic property, despite the fact that the city said you can't do this. So is this common that, or I guess I want to know that this was extraordinary, that somebody would take advantage of this in this particular way. Is this something that you've heard of before?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, in my experience, it's pretty common to have conditional uses in historic properties and historic districts that similar to that. But I certainly don't think that it's if they are doing it and they're not as against the law, then that's something I rarely hear about.
Thank you. Let's see, Mr. Stiver. Steiber for Marion County.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Conrad Steiber. I have a historical house here in Salem. We purchased the house and put it on special assessment, and we spent over $300,000 to make this a citadel of the city. So we put a lot of money into it. We did not go on special assessment just to pocket money saving taxes. And of course, we are in our last year. And of course, the amount of money we've put into the house has also been added on to the assessment. So the values are increasing. It's our feeling, my wife and I, that the house actually is part of the community. And we open the house to all different sorts of charities to hold fundraisers and so on, because we figure it is a community house rather than just ours, because only we're just the caretakers till unfortunately we're called off the planet, somebody else takes the house over. But one of the big problems we've found about, I'm a historical restoration architect also, and one of the things we've found, unfortunately, that in Oregon a lot of the beautiful old historical houses have been torn down. And this is a very important way to encourage people that have some of the finer historical homes to restore them and maintain them. Our own particular house, we find we still have a long ways to go. We're not done. Even though we spent $300,000 on the house, we still have a ways to go. And this is why the special assessment, as far as we're concerned, is somewhat of a help to us, of course, to do this. I think it's very important. Mr. Hamrick and others have said that, well, this should be restoration plan also with the application, which we highly agree with, because he's correct. There are some people that got the special assessment and just sat on it. Well, that was not the idea. And I spent 7 years on the Salem Historic Landmark Advisory Commission, and we did review a lot of people's earnest, sincere desire to restore their properties. And this was an incentive for them to do this, to get on the special assessment. And also, we do get national recognition that the home is known nationally as well as locally as a historical monument to our past.
Thank you, Mr. Stever. Let's see, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stever, as a Salem legislator, I have to ask where your house is.
It's 415 Lincoln Street South. It's two doors between the governor and ourselves.
I know the area, and I can imagine at the minimum $300,000. And thank you for your work in that. It's also a historic neighborhood and beautiful. Thank you.
I just had one question in that regard, and that is, again, it's the same question I'd asked Doug a few minutes ago. What is an open house, best case scenario, what does one of your open houses look like? A full guest book of how many?
We've had as high as 50 people.
Okay.
People know the house because we do open to charities, and they tell their friends about it and say, I got to go see the house. So we've found the open house is utilized. It's in the newspaper, and of course the Historic Landmark Advisory Commission of Salem puts out a bulletin which also cites them. And so we expect a bunch.
Excellent. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. My district includes Forest Grove, and I'm sure some of you know there are several historic houses in Old Town Forest Grove, and they do walking tours a couple of times a year, and they're very well attended. I have a calendar that has the historic houses they sold to help do some of the preservation, and I think this is very worthwhile.
We have kind of an unusual circumstance here in Salem. One of our historical districts, maybe 10 or 15 houses open the same day in the Christmas season.
Oh.
So that people can walk on down the block and go through several houses. And it's a big activity here. And most of these people have done marvelous things with their houses. So that it's a reflection that, yes, the funds are being well spent that we've saved.
This conversation just keeps flashing. Money pit, money pit, money pit. For some reason, I don't I'm not sure what that is.
But the main thing, too, is we wanted to create a house of beauty back to what it was.
Excellent.
And we felt we'd done that.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Mr. Stever? Thank you. Michelle Deister. On behalf of League of Oregon Cities. Michelle is going to volunteer for a work group. I can tell that right now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. Let me first say that cities definitely support the existing historic special assessment program for the reasons that Mr. Hamrick enumerated, the fact that it has saved a lot of houses that are very, very important to our community's character and history. We do have a couple of concerns with this particular bill, and I think they're ones that have been echoed by other folks here, and that is just that for the second 15-year special assessment, we would hope that there is some ongoing obligation on the part of those who would be receiving that particular tax benefit, and we don't see that in the bill as written.
So there is no plan required in the bill.
That's
a defect.
Yeah.
Okay. So a plan needs to be implemented in the bill. What's another issue?
From our perspective, we think that maintaining the sunset on this program is a good idea simply because it affords the legislature an opportunity to periodically review the efficacy of this particular expenditure.
Do you object to 15 years, Michelle, an additional 15-year sunset?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Just
so
don't
please
remove the sunset. It can
I
be or whatever.
I appreciate what you're saying. I interrupted you. I beg your pardon.
And particularly, sunsets we think are a great idea, particularly when it's a different local government partner that's shouldering the cost of the particular expenditure. So
if I understand correctly, that second amendment that you would propose would allow for 15 years. But first of all, they'd have to have a plan. That's amendment number one, and follow the plan according to what Mr. Hamrick has indicated. And then secondly, that they be allowed an additional 15 years extension, and that the sunset only be extended. It's not just a permanent extension. Okay?
Yeah, just maintain the sunset for whatever, so that at some point you have to come back and reevaluate the efficacy of this particular expenditure.
Okay. Third item?
The third item I would just say is that as a policy position, cities across the state, of course, have made a policy position to sort of hold the line on additional tax expenditure. So there are ways in this particularly difficult fiscal environment that I think this bill could be made a little less of a revenue impact for your local government partners. And I've listed a couple of those at the bottom of my testimony just for your consideration. For example, if the property is sold, perhaps the special assessment then goes away. Might be one way to partially mitigate the revenue impact of a second 15-year exemption period. Another option, perhaps, is to make this a local option so that those communities who really feel that they can afford to offer this incentive can do so, but those who are concerned about every dollar coming in this difficult environment have an opportunity to have a little more certainty in terms of knowing when those properties are going to be placed back on the rolls at their value.
Michelle, if it was a local option and Forest Grove or other places said, we really need all the money we can get, and so we're not going to do that, and then those properties go away from being subject to the special assessment, and we lose that, we begin to lose that historic value, is that of concern to the League of Oregon Cities?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I mentioned, we definitely support the existing program. I think it's just the second 15-year term in some cases in some communities is going to be considered a hardship.
So, Michelle, if a new application with a new stepped-up value had to occur at a sale or a transfer of the property, then that would give you a new step-up in basis if somebody wants to buy a property and then live in it for 10 years and then sell it, then at that particular point there could be a step-up that wouldn't preclude the next party from asking for the same kinds of consideration, but at the new step-up in value, at which point the city is made whole, as are all other taxing districts.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, I think that would help a little bit. And, of course, the other option, of course, is for the state to share in this by picking up the cost of the second 15-year period.
You've humored me to this point. Okay. Questions for Michelle, League of Oregon Cities? Michelle, I'm going to appoint you as a committee member. Let's see. Who's got the historic
property? Number three. This is my third work group, Mr. Chair.
Who's got the historic property? Oh, hello, Representative Escobar.
Wait a minute.
All those lovely houses.
100 years old. I'll be glad to work with you.
Okay. Would you do that and bring us back this amendment? Please, Representative Escobar can give you the notes necessary to get this worked out. And I'm also going to appoint one private citizen. Mr. Stever, what are you doing on your weekends now if you're not taking care of your property? This is probably a beautiful time of the year in your yards. I'm anxious to come up and see him now. So would that be all right if you worked with Michelle and Representative Escobar?
I would like to.
He's got a very new property where he lives compared to where you're at. So with that, I appreciate your willingness to serve. If you'll share telephone numbers right immediately following with Ms. Deister and Representative Escobar can get that.
And if I could just conclude, I think Mr. Stiebler's situation is really exemplary in terms of what he brings to the community of Salem, and it's certainly what we like to see in terms of historic property owners, somebody who sees himself as a caretaker and really that this house, they're just living in it temporarily. I think that's wonderful that he definitely goes above and beyond what is required in the program, and he's to definitely be commended for that. So
when the first pioneers got here, they had a whole bunch of Indians who had no concept of fee interest in property. The most they ever had was just a life estate in it. So, and I appreciate the great work that is being done. And colleagues, if you ever get a chance, we will have a chance. I think the sheriffs will open their home up while we're in the legislature for, I think, the annual fish And if the Stevers would open up their home at the same time, that'll give us an opportunity to go up and enjoy a nice fish meal and from the Oregon fisheries and those folks, and to see two grand champion old homes. Now, I haven't been in the Stever home, but if you want to take a giant step back 100 years and furniture and furnishings that have been maintained absolutely intact, I think Mr. Sterup calls it 8,000 square foot of antiques with paths all the way through it. So we look forward to hearing back a report from that committee in a couple of weeks. Let's plan to do that. Let's plan. If you'll give me an update 1 week from today, and then let's plan for a hearing in about 2 weeks from today, Michelle, so that we can keep this going. So just some sort of a contact in a week, and then a plan for about 2 weeks out. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2776 and wish you Godspeed in that regard. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2234.
House Bill 2234 removes the existing restriction on the number of electronic enterprise zones that can be located within existing enterprise zones. It extends the deadline from December 31st, 2006 to June 30th, 2009 for applicants to obtain required certification for property exemptions and corporate tax credits for facilities located in non-urban enterprise zones. Background on this is that currently there are four electronic enterprise zones. An e-commerce zone must be located within an existing enterprise zone. There are currently 49 designated enterprise zones in Oregon, and they can exist for 10 years. At the present time, 11 of 12 operational e-commerce projects are located in the Medford e-commerce zone.
Now, what did they do to attract them down there? Is there something?
We just know that economic development, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to need to get that formula. I feel another work group coming up.
Oh, God. What can I say?
Okay.
Except for the personal property exemption, eligible e-commerce projects are entitled to the same property tax exemption that other firms may claim if they're located in enterprise zones. E-commerce projects are eligible for a property tax exemption on personal property that is valued for as little as $1,000. Whereas other projects located in just normal enterprise zones have a personal property exemption that pertains to items valued over $50,000. So that's the piece there that really pertains to electronic commerce and to projects, the fact that they get this additional personal property tax. Okay.
In addition to the real property.
In addition to the real property. But I'm assuming in my analysis that were they not electronic enterprise projects, they would be entitled to a personal property tax on real property just because they're in an enterprise zone. So this is sort of separate. This is just the incremental impact, okay, for the personal property tax within the range of $1,000 to $50,000 that I estimate for this particular bill. However, okay, e-commerce projects are entitled to a 25% credit against corporate income taxes for their investments in capital equipment. Other projects located in enterprise zones do not have that kind of credit. Okay, the credit may be taken immediately if a tax liability exists, or it may be carried forward for a period of 5 years. The total amount of the credit for each project cannot exceed $2 million. The current deadline for applications for certification for a corporate income tax credit and property tax exemption pertains to December 2006. This deadline for projects that are designated as long-term urban renewal enterprise zone projects. And for these projects, the property tax exemption pertains to investments that range between $1 million and $25 million. The duration of the exemption is at least 7 consecutive years, but not more than 15 consecutive years. We did some very interesting analyses based on a lot of hard data and some assumptions. Okay, but we did have quite a bit of data at the account level for the 11 of the 12 enterprise zones e-commerce projects in Medford. Okay, based on that account level data, we could ascertain, for example, what the average size of the investment is. we could see how they phased in over time. And considering that out of four zones, we had 12 in four zones, we blew that number up and said, now what happens if we had that same profile overlaid on 45 other zones, okay? With the average assumption, you know, the assumption that they all had the exact sort of same staging, we used, for example, all right, we've got 45 zones instead of four zones that will now be eligible. The
now you say the other 45 zones. Are there, are, that's in addition to the four zones, so there would be 49?
49 in total.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
There are, we blew that number up, basically looked at the phasing of the four projects, and we decided that if we had 12 for four, we could potentially have over, let's say, a six-year period, 150 for 45. Other zones. Okay, that's just blowing it up. That's just proportional. We then looked at the phasing and said, all right, in Medford we had four, we had eight, then four, then two. So we're going to try out, we're going to phase this over a six-year period, coming online with initially, let's say, 30, then 30, then, you know, 20, and so on until we've kind of phased that out. We took the average investment.
How long does it take for these to come online? You know.
Well, I don't know how long it really took in the Medford area, but it seemed as if within a short period of time they started out with eight.
Representative Esquivel, you were on that city council.
I was past president of Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development when we developed this particular overlay. And that's what it is. It's an overlay into our enterprise zones. But what we did is when we first started, we were doing bits and pieces. And then what we eventually did was a blanket okaying for an e-commerce overlay.
So the e-commerce was secondary to the overall enterprise zone.
Correct.
And so you have folks that are attracted to the enterprise zone then realize that e-commerce could give them that more, that's much more attraction. What's the timing on it then?
I think we did accomplish this in 3 years.
Construction from if you got shovel ready sites, construction can get up and going, and you'd have people employed in less than 3 years.
That, or they can buy an existing building as part of it.
Do you have many vacant buildings down there?
Not that many, but we have a few.
Okay.
They used to have.
But I believe the criteria on this is you have to do 51% or more of your business online, or something like that. There's some stipulations in there about
in the code.
Online.
Okay.
Should be an e-commerce.
Do you know what that is? What that stipulation is?
No.
I can't remember what it
okay.
is.
Okay, we'll find that out.
Okay.
Okay.
Basically, to continue, Mr. Chair, we basically just used the average investment that had been made, and we assumed a one-year lag from the time the program goes into effect. We assumed, you know, a year to get constructed and then another a year before you could claim your first exemption or your first tax credit. And we did two scenarios for you, one in which we assumed that, this is for corporate now, the corporate tax credits, we assumed in the first scenario that the 25% credit would be taken in that first year, which means the liability would be there for them to take it. And in the second scenario, we assumed that there would be insufficient tax liability and we'd have to phase that out over the next 5 years. We assumed also over that period that they would, over that six-year period, they'd ultimately, you know, start out taking as much credit as possible, and then whatever carryover they'd take up to the $2 million limit.
Is the 25% based upon the investment in property, plant, and equipment? Is that what that is? Okay.
Okay. So that is the scenario that we used to come up with the numbers before you for the property tax credit. We also had data on the average amount that's used for that personal property tax exemption based on the existing properties in the Medford and the other, you know, electronic enterprise zones. And we assumed, you know, basically a phase-in for that, same kind of assumptions with the number of entities that would come online. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, and this is just one of the tools that we use, because during the recession that we've just gone through, the downturn in our economy here in the state of Oregon, I believe that our stability of our economic vitality in Southern Oregon wasn't as dramatically affected as the rest of Oregon.
and it was through things like enterprise zones, e-commerce overlays. It was also where we talked about shovel-ready sites. We went with Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development. We developed a grant program where you had a piece of property, and we would pay the upfront cost and get that shovel-ready, and then when you sold the property, you paid it back with interest, which was very good because we now have many sites that are ready to go in, and all you have to do is you walk in with your plans and you get your permit because all the hoops have been jumped.
Excellent. Okay, Mary?
That's basically it. The numbers are very small for the property tax exemption because, as I said earlier, it only pertains to that small segment of, you know, personal property between 1,000 and 50,000, and over that, if you could get that exemption even if you weren't in Elixir.
But the income tax credit could be as much as $10 million, well, $15.7 million in 07-08.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Isn't anybody else, Mr. Chair, dying to know where the 12th one is? It's 11 or in
yeah,
the 3rd?
Washington County, somewhere.
I could find out for you.
Not Washington County.
What was the question?
Where are
the other?
Well, 11 or 12 are in Medford. Where's the 12th?
Oh.
Where's the 12th project? I've forgotten.
I can only speak for 11.
If I can't turn out to be in Salem, I'm going to be really chagrined.
Okay.
I will let you know.
Let's see. We have the Deborah Buchanan and Ron Fox. Ron, why don't you come forward, please? And Deborah, we're going to ask you some questions. You're welcome to come forward, too. Let's have you both come up one time. Ron, you're involved in these kinds of things. Where is that 12th location?
So can we, you know, so we put a pool of money, and it's March Madness is picking your favorite winner. Chair Butler, members of the committee, I'm Ron Fox. I'm with the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. I manage the business development group. And a quick answer to your question, I believe the 12th project is in the Roseburg e-commerce zone. and I have to tell you, I'm doing that from memory. I didn't bring my notes with me today. Ron Fox, Economic Community Development Department. Just a little bit of background on the entire e-commerce zone concept. This concept evolved from a legislative initiative that I think occurred from the 1999 session, the formation of the Enterprise Commission. And the Enterprise Commission, appointed by the, was tasked to look at the Internet and e-commerce as a mode of business for Oregon business. And among several recommendations that came from the Internet Commission was a recommendation to provide an incentive based on the business investments associated with conducting business in an e-commerce environment, essentially doing the business over the Internet. And I think that's another important point. This relates to the investments made by businesses toward their ability to perform their business over the Internet. So it, as mentioned by revenue staff, it does have a limitation in that it doesn't incorporate the production investments a company might make, but rather in the e-commerce connections, primarily telecommunications and other facets associated with commerce over the Internet. It's been very successful, as you've noted in your testimony so far, in the Medford zone. I think Roseburg is the one, the other project. But I think there are pending projects in at least two of the other zones, just have proceeded more slowly, maybe some as a result of just the general global economy and the investment of business. The department submitted our proposal to increase the designation of e-commerce zone eligible sites from 4, which was the original legislation of the 49 sites, and our request was to increase that to 10 by making 6 additional e-commerce zone designations eligible. And I think the House Trade and Economic Development Committee has taken action to an amendment to raise that to the number of existing enterprise zones, which is 49, so it would basically remove the limit that was previously at 4. Our submitted recommended legislation was to take that to 10.
Ron, where are the other two zones? We've got Medford, obviously, is one. Roseburg must be the other.
Yes. Burns,
Oregon.
And Northeast Portland, And it's an urban enterprise zone, and it's sort of, and I'm not sure I can give you the exact geospatial zones, but it's north and east of the Lloyd Center area and goes as far, I think, as the Columbia Corridor area.
Okay. Any applications for either of these two sites at this particular point, the folks working on?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I think there are some pending projects in the Northeast Portland project. I meet sort of regularly with the Portland Development Commission staff, which manages that zone. So, but I can't give you an exact number, but in the last conversation I recall, they were discussing with businesses certain applications.
Lots of unemployment in Northeast Portland.
Mm-hmm. Chair Butler, representative of the committee, I think Northeast Portland is one of those inner-city urban zones that has a less than stellar economic picture, and so that's the designation of that enterprise zone within the city of Portland.
Some unemployment greater than average unemployment, and probably some community overall blight and difficulties in bringing people into a distressed community. Then,
Chair Butler, that would be a correct assessment.
Okay. Representative Bradley.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, thank you. But one of the things I wanted to say is that, of course, the site has to be a designated enterprise zone before we can even look at this e-commerce zone. And enterprise zones were set up to help those distressed areas. So,
like Medford and Roseburg?
Mm-hmm. Well, they used to be until he fixed everything.
Oh. Okay.
But yes, that's exactly right.
Thanks for that clarification.
Wow. Oh, man.
So the fact is that any place where these e-commerce zones are requested will be, as you described, probably an area with blight of some sort that needs to be fixed in, and will certainly be high unemployment areas. Otherwise, they wouldn't be an enterprise zone to start with. It's unfortunate that Mr. Fish, who is much more familiar with this, had to go back east because of health problems with his family. But I met with him a few times, and being on the Trade and Economic Development Committee, and he actually said that we wouldn't be seeing this kind of request. He didn't believe that the requests would come much slower, and we wouldn't be seeing this sort of impact.
One reason that I like to see the enterprise zone or the e-commerce zone over the top of an enterprise is that the enterprise zone is mostly soaked up by the local taxing entities. The e-commerce says, hey, we're going to give you some income tax rebate, and I think that that's really important for the state to come forward and say, we'll do something out of the state by forfeiting state general funds, as Ms. Ayala has shown us here. We'll forfeit some general funds in this process to allow these folks to come to town.
And Mr. Chair, that's the only reason I didn't like it. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hess.
Thank you. I was one of the sponsors of the e-commerce bill in 2001. And last year, Representative Bergen and I were on the committee that oversaw the rewrite and kind of the cleanup of our enterprise zone statutes. And if there was one sort of overall message that I got from that is that it's important to remember that every time you add a new economic development zone, enterprise zone, you are, in effect, watering down those that already exist. I mean, if the goal is to help develop economic development in Burns, then every time you add one somewhere else, you are taking away some of the attraction to Burns. And the argument or the discussion we had in 2003 was, you know, if you have every single county becomes an enterprise zone, then you've lost the entire reason for having any of them. So it's just something that you just need to take in consideration into this, along with the standards through which you have to qualify for this. Because if I recall, the enterprise zone in Roseburg, unless anything has changed, was the Dell computer call center?
Chairman Butler, Representative Hans, I believe that is the company that, and that was a part of the proposal that the Medford or the Roseburg group presented to Dell in their decision to open their customer service care facility in Roseburg.
Well, my point is, if I could, Mr. Chairman, call center jobs pay, those jobs pay about $18,000 a year. I'm not sure those are the kinds of jobs that we should be subsidizing through enterprise zones. I mean, we effectively have to subsidize those people at that salary. Now, maybe it's working out well down there, and I'm not suggesting that it isn't, but it seems to me there should be the discussion we had in 2003 was to raise the standards or at least make these jobs worth going after by giving these incentives. So it's just another sort of policy consideration.
We're in the past. Let me address that. I've got a small community investment at the SCIP program, the Small Community Investment Program, that says if you'll take out a family wage job and bring it out to Burns, Oregon, anywhere in Burns, Oregon, that you can have income tax free for up to 10 years off of your income, not off of the wage earnings from that job. That small community investment program has been around for over 4 years now, and folks are saying, wait a minute, you're going to have to make an awfully big carrot and a pretty good sized stick to beat me out to these distant areas. I mean, what do you do? What would you do to get a business to move to Fossil, Oregon, or to Monument, Oregon, or Dayville, or Long Creek? So, you know, how do you get a business to move out there? You've got a lot of unemployment. I've had as much as 30% unemployment mm-hmm. in some of these counties. 30% mm-hmm. unemployment, no, and the very low cost of living. And so, I mean, if you said we've got 10 $18,000 a year jobs up for grabs, sign up here, virtually everybody in town, which would circle one block and single file line, would line up looking for an opportunity to take a look at that. So it's relative. I realize that wouldn't attract very many people in the Portland or Beaverton area, but it would certainly give the attention of the folks in some of my district and in rural areas.
No, I mean, that's exactly the trade-off. Maybe an $18,000 job with no benefits works in Roseburg. I don't know, but, you know, when you say we brought all these jobs to Roseburg, these are not, you know, Intel engineering jobs, and I just think you just have to be careful with some of those, and you know, it obviously works down there, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. But
and my take on it, it sure beats the heck out of unemployment.
My concern is one further is because I don't know all the specifics. I don't know that we know what the definition of what's the criteria for e-commerce. I'm sure that's somewhere, and I hope we're
Deborah, would you fill us in on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue, and Mr. Chair, if I may, I would defer to Mr. Fox. I think their shop is probably much
okay,
more knowledgeable.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. I know that
right.
you're aware of it.
Chairman Butler, members of the committee, the e-commerce zone designation, as you've mentioned, is an overlay on the existing approval and designation as an enterprise zone. Those zones were designated at a time when those areas of the state were facing an economic distress. Now, in some zones, they may have improved their conditions in that period of time that designation is in place, but they, as a requirement for designation as enterprise zone. The definition for e-commerce is that you have to be able to document that a substantial portion of your commerce is conducted over the Internet, and I think that the measure that's currently used, I think was mentioned earlier, is 51% of your transactions are conducted over the Internet. So that's the criteria that's generally used to describe it.
Okay.
51% or more.
Yeah.
For example,
so I don't know that, you can also create jobs in Bangalore. In other words, is there anything that says that anything in terms of the number of jobs that have to be created? Because if you're doing more than 51% of your business over the Internet, you might have people, human beings, who are all over the world and not necessarily in Roseburg or Medford. They could be in Idaho or Bangalore. So is there anything in the legislation that says you have to have a certain number of jobs, or you have to have a certain number of people who are physically there? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
That does, and I think the jobs have to be physically present in the community to qualify for these kinds. I don't know, but I think it's a good point. I don't know that it precludes that same company from doing business in Bangalore or anywhere else in the world, but they are providing jobs in the community, and 51% of the overall commerce that's conducted in that location.
But do they have to provide a certain percentage of jobs in that? Do you see what I'm saying, of their overall, or could their entire workforce be in North? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, Chairman Butler, Representative Galazio. In order to apply for and receive the e-commerce zone designation, you have to increase your employment by 10% in order to be eligible. So there is, with these applications, an increase in the employment associated with the investment associated with the e-commerce zone. I mean, these are incremental increases in investments.
Over what beginning was the next question. If you got somebody that's moving in to this empty building that has zero employees that wants to use the e-commerce enterprise zone, or e-commerce over the enterprise zone, what's their number of, I mean, one job is 100% increase. Two jobs, is 50%. One job on two is a 50%. What?
Chairman Butler, it's the incremental increase. So if you have a company applying for the e-commerce zone benefits without employment at that location in Oregon, the new jobs would be the incremental increase.
Certainly.
Over.
So if they're not in existence, in other words, that's 100%
increase. I'm sorry, one more?
Galizio?
So there has to be a 10% increase in the employment by the firm.
But in that location.
In that location?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative.
And there are programs available that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe a free trade zone, which we also have in Medford. And that is a requirement that we give you a 5-year tax break on your property, on your personal property, your equipment, and things of this nature. And I believe the criteria for that, you had to at least have $12 and something an hour plus benefits on top of that in order to be eligible for that. I think something like that out of the free trade zone, which we have at our airport.
Chairman Butler, Representative Escobilla, I think you're referring to the what I would call the basic enterprise zone benefits, and in order to be eligible for the extension beyond the base 3 years, that the wages have to meet 150% of the county.
The county average. Yeah, that's right.
Yes. So that's a basic enterprise zone. That's the basic enterprise zone, which all 49 zones would apply, and that discretion to go from 3 years of property tax exemption for the incremental increase to 5 is a local discretion based on application and based on the 150% of county average.
Ron, what's the criteria for the selection of the 45 new enterprise zones?
Chairman Butler, members of the committee, those existing 49 are the result of an incremental increase over time by the legislature in the total number.
Mm-hmm.
You set the total number eligible, and at the time those zones became eligible, those communities applied based on their having met the criteria for a distressed economic area.
So at this particular point, what we're saying is that we're removing all of the restrictions on those other 49 enterprise zones. This bill would remove those so that the e-commerce zones would be overlays in every enterprise zone.
Chairman Butler, Representative of the Committee, the existing 49, let me back up and say it's the existing 45 enterprise zones that do not have e-commerce zone designation at this time could make application to the department if this legislation passed, and meeting that basic criteria, then we would grant to those 45 that e-commerce zone designation, and then they could entertain applications from businesses, incremental increase in employment and incremental increase in and investments.
Okay, quick question, Representative Riley.
And those new employees in the e-commerce zone have to meet not only e-commerce requirements, but the enterprise zone requirements. Is that correct?
Chairman Butler, Representative Riley, this is where, unfortunately, where I wished I had my friend Mr. Fisher to answer the question. I believe that is correct, but I would verify that for you and get back and let you know.
I think that's correct as well.
Thank you, and you have the advantage of having had Mr. Fish testify before your other committee representative. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Deborah, did you want to add at this time?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue, and we have worked closely with Mr. Fox and Mr. Fish, and what I'm here to talk about is not the e-commerce designation, but it has to do with some technical corrections that our attorneys have recommended in the long-term enterprise zone credit. And I don't know whether you would like to discuss those now or come back at a work
session. Why don't we plan to come back at another time? We've got members of our committee who are taking off from town and pushing the limits on a couple of those. Perhaps, Deborah, you and I could meet over that as well so that I'd have just a little bit of a briefing. I'd like to have further knowledge and information about that.
Be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Further questions, Ron or Deborah? Hearing and seeing none, colleagues, no meeting tomorrow. Again, travel safely. For those of you who are traveling all the way over to Baker City, points beyond,
we're going to go down and see what new and improved.
The new and improved areas in there. Have a happy Easter too. I am going home for Easter, so after Easter Sunday dinner, I may just lay out on the couch, and I won't see it probably Monday. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.